Mr. Hayward, really, 11. We're talking now, it's come to the point, after D-Day, you were moved up to Gosport on around about the 12th of June. What about that move? Anything about it? Did you go by road, or...?
Yes, I went by road. It wasn't too far away. And I think even the tanks went by road. And we entered a strip of woodland just outside Gosport. And as far as I recall, we were on the canvas. I think it was a rather posh under canvas camp, because I believe the tents had such things as floorboards. They weren't sort of sitting on the ground itself. And I believe there was a certain amount of rain while we were down there, and we didn't know how long we were going to be there, but at some stage or other we were briefed with what was going to happen.
Do you remember that briefing?
I seem to remember vaguely going to some large tent or building where there was a lot of room and we could all listen. And I don't think whatever was said to us was very long-winded. But we were told to be ready to move off. But the move off didn't occur immediately. I gather that due to weather conditions, it was delayed a day or two. But eventually we moved off early one morning, very early one morning. But the whole of the population on our route to the docking area, which I think they call Gosport Harbour, they built some special ramps there for the tanks and vehicles to go down onto the boats. But the population lined the streets and were cheering us on our way. And as that was then sort of D plus 8 or 9, yes, it must have been the night of D plus 8, because we landed on D plus 9. So that meant that the population of Gosport had been seeing this happen on successive days since D-Day. And they must have been highly delighted at seeing so much war equipment coming through Gosport destined for the Second Front. It must have cheered them enormously, and they were giving us a really good send-off. More so than he was giving credit to the average British person, that they seem to be very enthusiastic about seeing us off and getting this war over. So we were, you know, our spirits were raised by this sight. And then, of course, immediately we were, one by one, descending these ramps onto these landing craft, which turned out to be a landing ship tank in my case, because it was very large and had an upper deck.
So you just drove aboard?
Yes, I was co-driver, so I was driven aboard. And we were allowed to get out of the tanks once we were on board. We weren't sealed off entirely. The hatches hadn't been sealed off permanently. That would have been done on the way over. Once we got back in again. You'd probably be interested in the journey over.
How did you feel as you sort of, left harbour and sailed away from England?
Well, I was very interested, not knowing much about Portsmouth or Gosport, I was very interested in looking at the surrounding landscape as we left the harbour. I've certainly got vivid memories of seeing that huge building, the Royal Haslar Hospital, at the mouth of the harbour there, on the Gosport side, and the other buildings like the Portsmouth Cathedral and the docks. and various ships scattered around. That was a strange feeling, yes, leaving England, going, knowing you were going into battle, a very strange feeling, but an exciting feeling. And it was, after all, a beautiful sunny morning of June. We got up very early. I think we'd moved off before it was light. It was only beginning to get light as we'd gone through these crowds of cheering people. And so, if you can imagine June, well, that would have been probably about 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. And it took some time before we moved off. Probably, we were probably hovering around most of the morning. But eventually we moved off in a large group, then slowly chugged over the channel to France. And as I know that we landed...
What was the crossing like? Weather all right?
Beautiful. Yes, the weather was...
No seasickness?
No, it was wonderful. It was such a hot day by the time we got towards the noon midday.
Could you see a lot of other shipping or evidence of activity?
Yes, we could see, literally the sea seemed to be full of other craft of all sorts. And there would be the escorts with us as well, the naval escorts. But the wonderful thing about that crossing was that not only the weather was so delightful that we stripped off our top clothes and were literally sunbathing, as you might say, relaxing on the deck in the sun, enjoying the crossing and the sea air. That part of it was like a holiday, it was wonderful. But what surprised us was that we didn't hear any sound of any gunfire or any aircraft action. No naval guns firing. Naturally, we believe that no sign of any submarines or any warnings being given. It was just a very, very slow, peaceful crossing. And of course, going from the Gosport area, it would be a little bit further than saying going from Cleveland to Cherbourg. I would imagine that, I guess, it was at least 100 miles we had to do. So the normal boats would take 5 or 6 hours to do that. And we certainly took all of that because it was late afternoon when we got there.
And where were you getting to? Was this Haramoge?
This was Courseul, a place called Courseul, Courseul, which was more near the Canadian. Well, I think it was a Canadian. Officially, but we used it, and it was fairly near to the entry to the Calm Canal.
Could you hear the sound of gunfire when you got there?
I don't think we were very conscious of it. We were very nervous when we did land. We were all nervous about the thought that we might be fired upon immediately. We had no idea that the bridgehead had extended several miles inland.
How did you land? I mean, were you using an artificial harbour or did you just go ashore on the beaches? Or how did it?
Well, this landing ship tank had the sort of drop down type door at the front. And it had a drop down lamp. Whether the doors were hinged opening like house doors or whether they lifted up, I can't remember. But it was certainly a lamp. Which was dropped down into the seabed. And as it happened, we didn't go into very deep water. It certainly didn't come up. I would imagine at the most it came up perhaps to the drivers and co-drivers' hatches, but not above that.
Had they been sealed then, those hatches?
They had by then been sealed, yes.
Extra sealed, I mean...
Yes, something that we'd put on to seal them off after we got in.
Were you nervous about that?
Yes, I think I was a bit nervous because I heard tales about some tanks disappearing in very, very deep water and not being rescued in time. did worry us a bit, but we had nothing to worry about. The our ship had dropped to some fairly shallow water, and we got off quite easily.
Now, you were nervous about, you thought, you didn't realise how deep the bridgehead was. Not that it was that deep.
No, but we weren't told very much. I expect we could, if we'd studied the newspapers or heard the radio reports at the time, perhaps we didn't have access to that sort of thing, but we might have pieced together the fact that the front line must have been several miles inland, but we weren't particularly aware of that. We thought perhaps they were still fighting on the beaches, the sort of tail end of the fighting was still going on, and we were sort of ready for immediate firing, but it was completely unnecessary. The only thing that we noticed straight away, you were talking about smells in the tank earlier on, what we did notice was this horrible smell, which turned out to be the smell of dead cattle in the surrounding fields. That came into the tank, and we didn't like that very much.
How bad was it?
It was pretty overpowering, because some of these cattle must have been dead for several days.
This is where, would this be when you were moving inland to Cully?
Yes, it was.
Because that was your first, that was your, where you were going, wasn't it? Where you were.
Yes, my memory tells me that we did that journey that same day that we landed. Other people described the destination Cully as 7 miles away, which it was, I know. But I don't think it could have been much more than 10 miles. And we did use some roads and some fields, partly cross country and part roads. They must have marked out a track for us to take. This was all done beforehand. And I just have a dim memory of pleasant countryside and tiny little villages which you would see from a distance with their church towers sticking up, some of the spires, and pleasant Norman countryside, a lot of stone buildings, and all very sort of old. Put you in mind of some of the English roads as they were before Talbot was introduced. A lot of roads in Normandy in those days were still sandy, gravelly tracks.
And was there any sound of fighting, or what was
it? As we got nearer to Cully, we could hear distant gunfire. Yes, that became audible. But as it was distant, I don't ever remember during the time we were at Cully ever being scared by sort of shells landing nearby. It was extremely peaceful there from that point of view. I don't remember any aircraft raiding us. But if we were told to camouflage our vehicles when we got there against hedgerows, which we did by means of the camouflage netting.
Now, how did that work?
Well, you had netting, a little bit like tennis court netting, sort of square mesh, into which were woven strips of coloured hessian, long strips of coloured hessian, mostly browns and greens, to merge with the countryside. And you had to stretch, select some strong branches in the hedges, and stretch by means of the trailing strings on these nets, attach them as high up as possible over the tank, and stretch them out into the field beyond. And if necessary, use two or more nets to protect the ends. And as far as sleeping was concerned, you would also make you'd use a tarpaulin, the same tarpaulin that probably covered up your bedroom and kit on the back of the tank. You'd stretch that out. If there was a fence handy, you'd trail it over the fence and anchor it on the other side of the fence, and then stretch it out and form a sort of long triangle, and then the other end of the canvas, having weighted it down, you trail underneath to put your ground sheets on. So it would be an open-ended tent, which was tolerable in summertime. No problem here, but as long as you were covered up in case of a shower.
Now, what is this about the storage of things in the back of the tank? Could you explain this? This comes relevant again, because I know you had a fire in it or near it. How did you store this equipment on the back of the tank?
Well, things like anything bulky, like blankets. After all, there were five members of the crew, so you'd have five members' blankets plus, what should we say, perhaps mess tins. Although they could probably be kept inside the tank. But mainly blankets, spare clothing. A lot of this would be possibly put into kit bags. They were canvas bags with string tops. And anything else like the camouflage netting. So anything bulky like that and soft. Could be wrapped up in the tarpaulin and then tied onto the back of the tank over the engine covers. So, of course, the engine would keep that material warm. But it would be rather vulnerable if any trace of earth or hot shell fragments landed.
Could that be a fire risk which would spread back into the tank? If it caught fire properly, was it a risk to the tank?
It would probably be only a risk if it caught fire and in turn set fire to something under the engine covers.
But could it do that?
I would say it's possible, yes. After all, the petrol feed, and of course the petrol tanks themselves were on the side, one each side of the tank. Armoured, of course, not under the armour. But the access to the petrol tank was on top at the back. Yes, there probably was a little bit of danger there, but if something started flaming and the engine was running, it might get sucked in.
So, this becomes relevant, obviously, in a moment.
Yes, there was certainly a possibility of that happening.
So you were in these makeshift sort of bivouac tents using the thing. Now, what about food? Because there's a note in the war diary that you were on these 14-man packs. I think this is probably compo rations, as we would call it.
Yeah.
You hadn't been on that much before, I presume, in England.
No.
Could you describe exactly what it was and how? 14-man packs are difficult to use in a 5-man tank. How was your food sorted out?
Well, that would probably be enough if you were careful for 3 days.
So you wouldn't share with two other tanks. You'd have one box for your tank for 3 days.
Tank, yes, and hope that you get another box before it completely ran out.
And what was in the? It was actually a box.
Yes, it was a box. I can remember those quite well. They were sort of they were made with mats of wood. You get a rectangle of wood with a central bar across. And they would be nailed or stapled to a similar shaped thing underneath, rectangular box. What would that be about? Just over 2 feet long. Yes, just over 2 feet long, and about just under 18 inches wide, and about 10 or 11 inches deep. I seem to remember that the cladding was probably some kind of burly hardboard. Whether they had in those days, you know. It wasn't cardboard, it was something a little bit more substantial than cardboard. But that formed the casing. And then inside you'd have tinned foods largely. Almost everything was in tins. You'd get butter, if it was butter, it might have been margarine, in tins. Some of these tins were easy to open, they might have a pull handle on them. All sorts of different things. You'd have puddings, soup puddings, even roly poly puddings, I think, were put into tins and things like that. We loved these 14-man packs, so it was good food.
What was the main food? I mean, was it bully beef, or was it McConaughey's M&V, or what? I mean, what was the actual?
Oh yes,
there
would be bully beef.
There
would be things like stews in tins, stews and rice puddings in tins.
What did the men think of bully beef? I mean, when people joke about it, it's just corned beef now, it's called. But
yeah, I think basically the average soldier was quite happy with bully beef because it was, after all, meat, and it was nourishing, and there seemed to be plenty of it. And it inevitably appeared in any rations that were given out. Say, if you were out on an exercise, the cook struck would contain ready-made rations. And composed of bully beef or cheese or both.
And it was obviously in these compo ration boxes.
Yes.
I mean, would these tins, all the tins, would they be, how would you heat them, or would you heat them?
We had our burners, the stoves. I believe there were some primitive things that.
Who had, but each tank had one, or each man?
Each tank, therefore, had one of these prime stoves. Which was a rectangular box, and you could open the lid up, which formed the back to the cooker. I think there was only one burner on these cookers, so you had to do things one by one. But they were mainly used for boiling up tea. I mean, to cook up, say, one of these, or a couple of these tins of stewed meats with veg and that, meat and veg. You really have to be sure that you weren't going to be called into action. You have to be sure that you could have time to do it.
So how would you do it? I mean, would you heat them in the tin and then open it and then cook it in the tin, or would you pour it into a mess tin, or how would you heat it?
There are two methods. One was to boil them up like baked beans in their tins, heat them up in the tins in hot water. And some just tip them out, as some do, and heat up baked beans. Tip them out into a Dixie and heat them up, you know, perhaps by adding a little bit of water to them.
Was it communal cooking as a tank, or would you cook each have a go on the primers for 5 minutes sort of thing, you know?
It was communal cooking in a tank, amongst the tank crew, yes, if you were enabled to do that. But I think, from memory, in action, we very rarely had to do that. That was why quite often we had tins of food like that left over, which we often used to barter with the French people for other things. So the reason I say that is because after action, at night, when the tanks...
I'm more really on about this first period at college, yeah.
Yes, because basically the cooks would be at some layback point, out of action, out of the battle zone, where they would produce a meal for the tanks at night.
But that wouldn't be the composition food?
No.
I'm sticking really to how you cook the compo at the moment.
We would have to use the primer stoves, because the only other way, which was sometimes used when they had trouble, these primer stoves often gave trouble because the jets on them got quickly clogged up with black stuff, soot. And you were constantly cleaning them with this little tool, you know. And they were difficult to get started and get them up to the right heat. They weren't the ideal means of cooking, but we had to use them, but mainly for tea and soups. So another method of cooking, which was frowned upon, was to fill a tin. You can find one of these, say, old type petrol tins, and saw it in half. You could fill it with sand or earth, and then pour petrol in it, and set light to it. And there you've got another means of cooking. You could stick. You have to put up the fact that you're all black. Mind you, the Dixie's got all black on the primer stoves anyway. So you're constantly cleaning it with anything available, like grass, anything you could pull up, you know, scrub them.
Would you sort of, how many tins would you cook at a time? Say you were having meat stew. Would you get two or three tins out for the five of you, or was it one each? Or
I would think probably a couple of tins would do for the crew. They were sizable tins, so a couple of tins would do the five crew. through them with anything else that was going, like a rice pudding. When you ask me about what the cooks use, I would think that they have to also use the 14-man packs. Undo several boxes and cook those up, because after all, they wouldn't have access at that stage to any fresh meat supplies.
Now, but the cooks weren't cooking for you at Cully, according to this anyway, according to the war diary. It seems to think you were mainly just on the compo yourselves. But that's not how you remember it.
That is quite possible, that we were probably getting used to the 14-man packs at Cully, but I do remember having a cook strapped there and seeing them in action, in action with their burners.
So tell me, that's the other way. How would the cooks prepare a meal, and what they've used the same sort of ingredients, but they cook it for you, I presume?
Yes, well, they had enormous dixies, of course, which they put onto iron grids. They've made a sort of a shallow trench first in the field, very shallow, to put these iron gridirons on, which were shaped to take individual dixies, which were very large indeed, probably the size of perhaps three buckets. So you could get a lot of food in those dixies. And they were placed on these grids, and then one of these special cooked burners was placed at each end. And they were all away. They sounded rather like these heaters you get in sort of garages. These sort of, almost like flamethrowers, they were blasting hot air into a rather bit of a shambles of an area, you see. So of course, using that type of burner, which was under pressure, I would imagine it was either petrol or paraffin they used, one at each end, it would heat these dixies up fairly efficiently, because they stopped the hot air escaping along the sides of these grids. They would put turves of grass all along and keep the heat moving along this channel underneath the dixies. And they produced a very satisfactory meal by those means. They could give you whatever you wanted, porridge in the morning if you wanted it. They could cook up like these stewed meats.
What was it like?
Oh, it was very good. It was excellent food.
Would it still be hot when it got to you? They used hay boxes, didn't they?
Yes, it could be by means of hay boxes if it was transported away from the cooking area. Yes, it did. But those hay boxes were very good, very efficient.
Now, the other thing is, when you're hardly getting any food at all, were you still getting issues of, like, First of all, army biscuits, like dog biscuits? Were you still getting those issued?
Yes, you could still get those, I think, for a time, even after we got bread. You could always find a packet or so of those to keep in the tank.
What were they like? Were they edible?
Yes, they were edible. A little bit like those... A harder version of those sort of wafer biscuits you get, those square cheese biscuits, water biscuits, nothing much in the way of flavour to them, but you could make a meal out of them.
What else would you carry in the tank? You seem to mention sweets.
Yes, the compo 40-man packs did have tins of sweets in, and small bars of chocolate, and vitamin tablets, Halts, and they had yeast tablets. And I certainly used to eat those, used to take them in.